The life of McCartney, who's currently on tour again as we speak, has been much scrutinised, as you'll know, but just re-examined in a new biography by the acclaimed British historian of popular culture, Philip Norman. It's surprising, in a sense, that he was given the tacit approval to write the bio, because he was one of the music writers who made popular the divisive idea that John Lennon was the superior talent of the Beatles. So the story of how this latest book came about is fascinating, and for McCartney aficionados, the less explored ground of his post-Beatles decades, the music, farm life, love with Linda McCartney and his very public split from his second wife, Heather Mills, his contribution to contemporary Western culture, all of that's there and will prove rewarding. Philip Norman is the author of Paul McCartney, the biography. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning to you.
When you decided to write the biography, did you expect Paul McCartney to give it his blessing or involvement? I mean, that usually helps a biographer.
I didn't. I was very surprised, because usually you go through lots of protecting others. But I had an email directly from him, and it was very short. And it was a surprise, though he had helped me with the biography of John Lennon. He answered questions by email, questions that only he could really answer. And so I was unwise, in fact, to say that John was Father's superior creative partner. I got that wrong, and I absolutely withdraw it. They were an amazing team, a symbiosis, really, more than a team.
Yeah, so in a way, you introduce your book with a mea culpa, an explanation, perhaps, as to why earlier on as a younger man, you'd made this poorer assessment of McCartney. What lay behind your assessments of the songwriting contributions of the two? I'd really like listeners to hear that.
It's as Dr. Johnson once said when he was taxed with an inaccurate entry in his dictionary. His reply was, "Why did you do that?" "Ignorance, ma'am, ignorance," was his reply. I never thought about writing on the subject of the Beatles for years. I thought, everybody else in the world is doing this. There's no room for me in this at all. I was just one of those young men who wanted to be him. I had no idea that being a Beatle was actually pretty awful at times. I just simply wished I was Paul. And there was, you sort of felt envious of him. And then when I had him at the end of a pen or on a typewriter, I just thought, I've got to be tough, you know, and I was too tough.
You're very honest about yourself. You said no one really wanted to be the other three, really. It was Paul.
Many wanted to be Ringo. But actually any of them, really, you know, for a long, long time, because they just seemed to live in this sort of wonderful bubble of everything being the best in the world they were enjoying. When I got the story and I realized what they'd been through and how, after the Beatles broke up, each of them was like a survivor from a dreadful war. I mean, they really were in denial for years about what had happened to them. They couldn't get to grips with it at all, because they always had to be the cuddly, lovely Beatles. Whatever they were told to do, they would do, usually because Brian Epstein, their manager, had asked them to do it. Rock bands aren't like that. They never were. Well, the Beatles weren't a rock band anyway. They were the Beatles. Mm. But they always just did their best to be obliging and nice. Even John, for the sake of the brand, the sake of the others, would just go along with things he hated doing.
And I mean, for Paul, just before we leave that early bit, I mean, you have the courage, as it were, to note your own shock and even devastation that Paul left the lovely Jane Asher, who seemed so perfect for him, this very rather classy young actress, and hooked up, as it were, with an unknown American photographer named Linda Eastman. As you say, on their sudden wedding day in 1963, dry-eyed men like me wondered, what on earth could he be thinking?
That's true, because everyone felt proprietorial about the Beatles, and that seemed like a perfect match. As you say, a very classy actress from a rather upper class family who lived in the West End of London. Paul, of course, came from a suburb of Liverpool, Allerton, not a very wealthy suburb. He came from a very, very good family. They didn't have much money. We realized he was on a course of self-improvement, and that seemed the next step. What actually Linda Eastman, as she then was, she was cool.
Yes, well, she was a very interesting woman, a woman of considerable conviction and a very strong family woman, which he clearly loved. Look, I have to ask you before we go any further, why another biography? I mean, what areas of Paul McCartney's extraordinary life are unknown to us, if indeed they ought to be known?
Well, of course, you know, almost everybody think they know the whole story because most people know the milestones of the story. But in this case, the revelation is the character of Paul McCartney. You would have thought that someone with such gifts, I mean, not only huge talent, but also amazing good looks, charm, everything, would be very smug, very complacent. He's not. He, in his own way, as insecure as John used to be. John was the most insecure person about everything. Paul isn't insecure about everything, but about his own talent. Music and his own talent, he is.
Yes, I really found that most interesting indeed, because his childhood upbringing, you really dig for extra details and you go to the, you remind us of the Liverpool of yesteryear. And this very good childhood of Paul McCartney, was that a bit of a surprise to you?
You know, he was brought up really by his father. His mother died when he was 14, and he and his brother.
Which was devastating. Were
terrible. And, you know, just at the moment when boys actually need their mothers probably most of all. But their father, Jim, never earned more than about 10 old pounds a week on the Liverpool Cotton Exchange when Liverpool still had a cotton industry. But he just gave them a really wonderful, secure home, and he learned to cook, and he was a wonderful man. And he also was the only music teacher that Paul ever really had, because Jim McCartney had a little local jazz band back in the 20s and 30s. And so he really opened Paul's ears to things like Hollywood show tunes, brass band music, Anglican church hymns, that kind of thing. All of which, of course, later came into Paul's music.
Yes, and of course, he took up the guitar where Jim had been the big trumpet man, hadn't he?
He bought Paul a trumpet and he allowed Paul to swap the trumpet for a guitar. Whereas John, who's only like a quarter of a mile away, but in a very different kind of suburb, much more middle class, his aunt, Mimi, who he lived with, she wouldn't have a piano in the house because she said it would be like a pub.
Philip Norman's my guest here on Saturday Extra. He's an author who's written biographies of Lennon, Elton John, Mick Jagger. He's now written a companion book, Paul McCartney, the Biography. So because you do want, I think, us to think of life beyond the Beatles. And when he basically did form Wings, Paul, after going up to Scotland, actually, I've just got to read the amazing, no wonder, I'm amazed he spoke to you. You wrote a satirical poem about him after the release of Mull of Kintyre in the Sunday Times magazine. Oh, deified scouse with unmusical spouse, for the cliches and cloy you unload, to an anodyne tune, may they bury you soon in the middlemost midst of the road.
Well, of course, that sounds in the most horrific bad taste now since the death of John, obviously, but this was a long time before that. But it was still a very horrible thing to write, and I was very proud of myself for rhyming scouse and spouse, journalist doggerel, really. And again, yes, has anybody burnt his bridges more than that, you think? But somehow, in the end, it came right.
But the point is the Wings, which the unmusical spouse was part of, and gradually... It became quite a success, didn't it, the band? They did have quite a few hits.
It took a long time, actually. John was doing much better as a solo artist to begin with. And even Ringo was starting to have hit singles. George had his huge triple album, All Things Must Pass, which turned out to be pretty much all George had in the bottom drawer that he hadn't been allowed to record with the Beatles. But it took 2 or 3 years for Wings to really sort of make it, and he had terrible reviews. The critics were, I mean, nearly as bad as I was. You know, other people were just as horrible about Linda, which Linda couldn't play. She was learning in front of paying audiences, but Paul decided he didn't want to go touring and leave her behind, so he wanted to have her on stage in the band.
Amazing, really. I mean, that totally different sort of gentle, soothing Mull of Kintyre, released, as you point out, the same year as the Sex Pistols released, never mind the bollocks, a bit of a contrast. I mean, what were his instincts telling him then?
Well, in fact, his instincts were quite right, because this was right in the middle, yes, of punk, which was like sort of year zero for pop music. And all the, you know, the old-fashioned super bands were like for the French aristocrats, you know, after the fall of the Bastille. They were waiting for the tumbrils to come and get them. But Paul produces, he realizes there is a huge sort of middle-of-the-road audience that's not listening to punk. And so he realizes that the English still have this sentimental fondness for songs about Bonnie Scotland, you know, the glens and all of that, and the lochs. And so, of course, it was a massive hit.
And then came the death of Linda McCartney when she was, I think he was 55. It's very sad, actually, rereading it. And I'm going to move on fast to an extent to say that one of the motivations for you writing the book was to explore these later parts of his life. Some of that has played out in the gossip pages. You detail the very messy split with his former wife, Heather Mills. Did you really find any extra insights there?
Well, I did. I mean, to begin with Linda, what Linda realised that he wanted was a home and a family. Mm. This was, you know, the most eligible bachelor in the universe. That was what he really wanted. He wanted to settle down, have a family. She brought with her a daughter already that she'd had with her first husband, who Paul adopted. So they managed to have a family life as well as a rock and roll life. She was diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was, you know, a long and painful decline that she went through. And then pretty much almost immediately he meets, someone who had been a model was by then a charity campaigner because she'd lost part of her leg in a horrible road accident. A very, very strong person, very vigorous. And I did actually find out much more than I wanted about that because I'd taken Heather at her word that she would never talk about the marriage because I assumed she'd signed a confidentiality agreement. And then I looked on my phone one day, and I'm not someone who sends or receives text, but I did happen to sort of tap a text which ran to about 1,000-word text from Heather, which was in fact like an interview. It was like answering all the questions I hadn't actually asked her. And then later on, she sent me a DVD she'd made, an anti-Paul DVD. So I actually have much more information about Linda since I finished the book and about Heather's perception of the marriage and Heather's grievances against Paul. Because, as you know, she tried to get £100 million in settlement from him, which would have been by far the most expensive divorce ever. She did get a pretty large sum anyway.
I suppose I have to ask you, by way of a semi-final question anyway, is what drives him? I mean, he's really had a remarkable life.
Unbelievable. Amount of hits, honours, adulation. You know, he's 74, and many nights of the year, perhaps most nights of some years, he's on stage, and he's doing 3 hours without an intermission, without a sip of water. I defy you to find any band of any age that is doing that. And it's because he still wants to prove that he can get an audience and hold them like he always did.
Look, thank you very much indeed. And congratulations on tackling something that I would have thought didn't need to be done. But and all the pictures and everything, it's fabulous. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Philip Norman, his new biography on Paul McCartney, published in Australia by Hachette. Shout, The Beatles of Their Generation, is his classic.